The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Welcome to the future you. Frank Lloyd Wright once said, "Study nature, love nature, stay close to nature, and it will never fail you." At Zija, we love nature. We study nature. In India, we discovered Moringa and created Moringa Supermix, a revolutionary new combination of organic ingredients, including natural vitamins, minerals, proteins, antioxidants, and omega oils. Zija's new Moringa Supermix will help you make a change for the better. Simply click on the Zija banner on the UKHealthRadio.com homepage. Power people need power vitality.
Hello and welcome to the Yes to Life show. I'm Robin Daly, and as usual for the show, I'll be focusing in on some aspect of integrative medicine for cancer. This focus derives from the mission of the UK charity Yes to Life that I set up in 2005 to help people with cancer to understand and access integrative medicine. This week, I'm talking to two people about their very different fields of work and about the upcoming new Complementary Therapy Awards, which they're both enthusiastic supporters of. The awards, as I said, are new this year, and we'll be giving recognition to exceptional innovation and success in these categories: prevention and self-care, cancer care, palliative care, complementary therapy research, mental health and well-being, pain management, injury prevention and rehabilitation, and furthering integrative healthcare. The awards ceremony will be on the 18th of October. The awards are sponsored by the Federation of Holistic Therapists, and our own UK Health Radio are the awards media partner. The first person I'm talking to today is Jennifer Young, a beauty despite cancer.
Hi Jennifer.
Hi Robin, how are you doing?
Really well, thank you. Thanks so much for joining us on the Yes to Life show. Talk about your brilliant initiatives under the heading of Beauty Despite Cancer.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
So, Beauty Despite Cancer is many things for many people. There's a blog, there's information and product resource, it's a training school, it's a cancer centre and more. And I want to try and give our listeners a fair idea of all that you do. But first, I wonder if you mind telling me why and how you came to work in such cancer-specific areas.
Sure. I think you're right, actually, that I do too much. And that's one of my main challenges, is to stop doing some of the things that I do, because I just see this as a real area of that's been neglected. People who are going through treatments for cancer have various side effects of their mainstream treatment, and nobody really was addressing those before we came into this area. The reason that we came into it is because my local hospital asked me to. I live in the middle of England, and I was approached, I think about 7 years ago now probably, by our local NHS cancer centre. Some ladies there very much wanted a specific and specialist skincare range. They wanted me to help them to develop some skincare for cancer patients, or actually, I think more properly, they wanted to help me to do it. It definitely wasn't on my radar. I didn't understand why anybody would want a skincare range for the period during treatment. I just didn't know anything, really. Wow. But I am really nosy, and I love to learn, and I was invited onto a chemo ward. Yeah. To talk to lead chemo nurses, lead radio nurse, people who've been through treatment and people who are going through treatment. And that, to me, was just this fantastic opportunity to learn. And off I went to the chemo ward, and I did. I learned an awful lot. I now know considerably more about the skin, nail, lip, hair-related side effects of treatment. Mm-hmm. And it became my mission to open up the world of beauty to those who are going through treatment for cancer, because traditionally they have been denied access to those services.
Mm. Right, yeah, well, I bet you do know a lot about that, and we're going to find out some of that, I think, during the show. Thanks. So I want to ask you first now about the products that you do make specifically to help address some of these many issues that women and men experience going through cancer, and as you mentioned, particularly going through conventional cancer treatments. I'm right in thinking that you've basically developed many of these directly yourself to address specific conditions?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. I went into the chemo ward knowing nothing and asked them, my first question was, why do you want a skincare range for cancer patients? And they were very eloquent in their reasoning. And it basically becomes clear that there's all kinds of specific skin-related side effects, and the products that they were being offered to combat those weren't doing it on a beauty level. So, for example, dry, sore, itchy, sensitive skin is really common side effects of chemotherapy. The people who previously accessed beauty products were now being offered E45 and aqueous cream as their beauty regime, and that just wasn't good enough for them. And they wanted something that met with their philosophy, first of all. That was the thing that was most important to them. And when I asked them what they wanted, the patients were very clear in their description that they wanted something that was natural and organic. They said those words to me before anything else, before we got to specific conditions. They wanted natural and organic. And when I speak to groups of patients around the country and I ask them for their wish list, if you were in this position in Stoke, what would you have asked for? They always come back with the same two things first of all as well. So for the clients that we work with, the brand philosophy is actually more important than the effectiveness of the products. Now, I don't know how long that would last if we made products that didn't combat their treatment-related side effects, that didn't help with their dry, sore, very sensitive skin. I don't know how successful we would be, but the first things that people say to me always is natural and organic, and then we move to, well, my nails are ridged or my nails are falling out or my skin is very reactive and very sensitive and itchy. I'd like something to calm it down.
Mm. Well, look, that's really encouraging to hear that so many of the public are interested in natural organic. I mean, you know, from my perspective, that has to be a great thing. Was that kind of naturally your area before this?
Yeah, it was very fortuitous because I wouldn't have been able to help them with anything that wasn't natural and wasn't organic. Okay. It's just part of my whole being. I wouldn't be interested in doing anything that wasn't plant-based. But if the question was a large one, was I a skincare formulator already? The answer is no. My background is in science, my first degree is in biology, and I have postgraduate degrees in occupational health and in law. And I came to a point in my life, having worked in the field of health for a really long time, that I was moving into a different area. And that was therapy. So I was retraining as a massage therapist, and aromatherapist, nutritional therapist, and product formulator. And I was exactly at that point in my life of change when they asked the question. So I went into the meeting with a therapy future and a scientific background. And that, again, was really lucky because the nurses, when they entered the conversation about what was okay for a skincare range and what wasn't, I drew on that science very heavily. So I appear to have been in the right place at the right time with the right kind of background. And I suspect that I always think that I had absolutely no choice at all but to do what I do, because nobody gets asked by the NHS to do anything. And then I was. Mm. So I feel as though this is what I have to do.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Yeah, it really sounds like it fell into place. So do you want to tell me some of the really specific problems, the key problems that you think you can help to address with your products?
Yes. We match our products to the condition. So, for example, when we were developing these products, I used to be given a brief, which would be a very brief brief. My nails are ridged and fragile and flaking, and some of them fall out. I'd like something to help with that. Or I've got itchy skin, or my lips get really sore. So I would then come out of the hospital, back into the lab, and I would create products which I hoped met with the brief, which was really scientifically specific from the nurses and still had to be natural and organic. And I would put them together, I'd put a sticky label on them, and on them I would write nail oil, itchy skin oil, lip balm. And I'd go back into the hospital and we would go through that process. And when we'd refined the products to match those conditions, the solution to the problem, we could say, then I said, right, what are we going to call them? And they all looked at me and said, what do you mean, what are we going to call them? They're nail oil, itchy skin oil and lip balm. So that's what we have. We have a collection that's called Defiant Beauty by Jennifer Young, but the products themselves are called itchy skin oil, nail oil, and we have a lip balm, and we match with more conditions with that. Those three products are far and away our most popular, but we also have really popular products that are healing hand balm, mild mint foot balm. So we're very closely linked to the problem that we're trying to solve.
Okay, that's what it says on the tin.
Yeah, so it does.
Right. So, now we're going to move on quickly, because I said you do a lot of things, to hearing about the training you do. So you have a whole slew of courses on offer, and many of them are cancer-specific, and I assume that they're all chosen for the benefits they offer people with cancer. Do you want to tell us what you offer, for who you're offering it, and where you do?
Sure. That was the other major injustice that drove me forward. So if we just put this back into context again, I was moving into a therapy future from a scientific background. I was working on an NHS chemo ward with these fabulous people who, my mantra is always, women don't stop being women when they're diagnosed with cancer. If they wanted beauty before, they want it now. Arguably need it more now. They certainly feel often that they need it more now. So I was coming to my therapy future, being taught my therapies with a scientific background, and all entry level therapy qualification teach us not to touch cancer patients. It's a contraindication. If somebody fills in their form and they tick the cancer box, then we can't touch them. And I'm a scientist. I ask why. I'm working with all of these lovely ladies who I can see really want to access this. I'm being taught not to touch them. I ask them why. And the answer wasn't satisfactory on a scientific level. So that then was the second injustice. The first injustice was that the world of beauty products were denied to people who are going through treatment. And the second was that they, if they wanted to go to a spa or a salon, they would be turned away. And I asked the question, why are they turned away? And there's lots of myth and there's lots of rumour and there's lots of stories, but there was no hard science to suggest that it was appropriate for all of these wonderful organisations to turn away cancer patients. Mm-hmm. And the irony of it was that the people in the organisation didn't want to turn them away. They just were told to. They couldn't get insurance to work with cancer patients, and they didn't know what to do to in order to avoid causing harm. So the turning away was driven by good intention, but it isn't good enough for me. I just felt that it was a massive injustice, and so decided that we were going to create some courses that allowed spas to welcome those who are going through treatment for cancer, and that we were going to get insurance in order to deliver those courses, and that we would get some insurance for those who came to our courses. And that actually was a really big deal in the spa and beauty industry and the wellness industry as a whole, that because that just hadn't happened before, but it clearly needed to happen, so that's what I did.
Good for you. So can you tell us, so this is available to who, and where do you run the courses?
We run the courses across the UK. We have two distinct types of courses that we run. The first is open to anybody who has an entry-level qualification in massage, beauty, manicure or pedicure. So we don't take people from the very beginning. They have to have an industry standard level of qualification, and then we offer postgraduate training, CPD training, so that a massage therapist can come to us and learn how to adapt those skills that they already have in order to welcome cancer patients. And we have centres across the UK. Our furthest north is in Edinburgh and our furthest south is in London. We have them in places in between. They're just open courses that therapists are welcome to book onto. The other type of course that we do is in-house spa courses. So we work with some very large spa groups and we go into their organisations and train their therapists so that the spas can have a Jennifer Young section on their spa menu.
Brilliant. So, moving on quickly again, I understand that you've been heavily involved in a flagship cancer centre in London, the Guy's Cancer Centre, and there's a lot of patient involvement in the design and planning of it.
Yeah, that actually was a really great thing to be involved in, and the NHS is very proud of the way that they have listened to the patient voice through that process. My involvement, I wouldn't say, was significant. It was more at the very beginning and at the very end, and by the time we got to the end, I'd actually forgotten that I'd been involved in the beginning. The timeline was so long. So I do recall, but I think, again, maybe 6 years ago now, I had a phone call from somebody who said, we work with the NHS, we're planning a cancer centre in London, we're working with patients, and I found out about you and what you do, would you like to be involved? And I said, yeah, that would be great, thank you very much, yeah. And then didn't hear anything at all for another 5 years.
By which time
I'd genuinely forgotten all about it. And then I was on holiday in Croatia. I received a phone call from the office that said, there's a lady in London talking about the cancer centre who really wants to speak to you. Can you call her back? Yeah. So I did, and it transpired that it was the same project, but it was now coming to its end point. The building was up, and the patients, when they had been involved in its design, had specifically asked for a one-stop shop for them that allows them to deal with all of their appearance related side effects.
Right.
And it actually then became two units. One of the units is a wig salon, so it's just like a hair salon but only for wigs.
Yes.
And the other is a retail unit that is filled with all kinds of products that will help one as one goes through treatment with all of the appearance related side effects. We were invited in to provide some spa services is the best way to describe them, and to retail our products. There's another person who's involved who does head coverings. The wigs were in the retail units as well, and there was a very large organisation that were invited in to work with the lingerie side of things, the mastectomy, bras, etc. And together, that unit does exactly what it set out to do. It helps people. You can walk into that unit after having a double mastectomy, and within the expertise in that room, everything will be sorted. If head coverings is a concern or wigs, then experts are on hand. If one doesn't know how to reapply eyebrows that might have been lost to chemotherapy, then that's what we do. We can help you with that. And it was really such an honour to be involved in that project because it was driven by patients. And I'm the biggest advocate of the NHS, and they do talk an awful lot about patient voice. They listen to the patient voice, but the difficult thing is doing something about it. And at Guy's Cancer Centre, that's exactly what they did. They listened to the voice of the patient, and then they went out and looked for other organisations who could help deliver exactly what those voices have been asking for. And it's a real step forward for them, and they're very proud of it, and rightly so.
Mm, I agree. You're dead right, of course. There's been so much talk about patient choice and patient-centred care, but virtually no action whatsoever. So it's very good to hear when they actually do something like that.
Yeah, it was.
So I'm coming to the end, but I want to finish by talking about the new Complementary Therapy Awards that UK Health Radio and the Federation of Holistic Therapists are behind. I know you're really supportive of this new initiative. Why do you think it's important?
I find it very frustrating that complementary therapies aren't taken seriously. I'm a scientist. Before I did any of our course material together, I looked at the research and the evidence and wanted to know that we weren't going to do any harm, that we were going to do only good. And it was my expectation that good would be done, but that was based in anecdotes and scientists don't really go there. So I was looking for the evidence, and even I was surprised how much evidence there is, real proper research about how much measurable good complementary therapies can do. But it seems that each party is a little bit wary of the other. I think complementary therapists sometimes are quite disdainful about the medical profession, and equally the medical profession don't always take complementary therapy seriously. And I'm happily standing with one foot in each camp. I used to train healthcare professionals, and I still continue to train healthcare professionals. It's just now I talk to them about what I do now. Previously, it was about other things. So I've kind of grown up, been very comfortable around doctors, and sometimes I have a confrontational style, not a problem for me at all. Bring it on. I'm delighted to be able to enter into that arena. Equally happy to work with complementary therapists, but I think I'm quite unusual in that I appear to be accepted by both parties. And I think these awards do nothing but bring those parties together and help them to see things from another's perspective.
All right, thank you very much. So very lastly, would you tell us how listeners can get your products, access your training, or sign up for your blog?
Sure, they just need to go to the website. The web address is www.beautydespitecancer.co.uk, and everything is on there. There's a menu at the top. One of the options is the shop. That's got the products in. Another is the training school, and they can learn more about our training there.
Fantastic. Thanks very much for talking to us today, Jennifer, and for doing so much to help people with cancer, not to mention charities such as Yes to Life.
Oh, well, the filmer is an honour. Thank you for inviting me. And equally, it's an honour to be able to do what I do. I genuinely consider it to be a privilege.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye, Robin. Thank you.
Now I'm going to talk to a GP who has been pushing the frontiers of the role of the GP and of medicine in general in a large variety of ways, not least of all in his own practice. I'm talking to Michael Dixon over the phone. Hi, Michael. Many thanks for coming on the show today.
Well, it's a great pleasure.
We're talking about the upcoming Complementary Therapy Awards, but before we get to that, I wanted to introduce you and your work to our listeners. Firstly, to say that you're a GP, first and foremost, and a massive supporter of the role of the GP in the community as a central focus for health, and also that you don't necessarily see health as exclusively the province of pharmaceutical drugs. In fact, you have a very unusual practice down there in Columpton. Can you briefly tell us what's different about your practice and why you've taken it in the direction that you have?
Well, I think our practice, like the College of Medicine, believes that medicine needs to go beyond pills and procedures. So we have a large variety of different ways that people can be helped, either through complementary medicine, there are 12 different practitioners working in the practice, or often by patient self-help groups for fibromyalgia, back pain, and the like. And we also have the NIS and NATA groups for particularly isolated elderly. And I suppose the overall ethos is about empowering and enabling local people and the population to help themselves as a sustainable means of the health service going forward without requiring ever more professionals and resources. It's also about connection with the community. We see our facility as not simply about having consultations with patients, not simply about caring when they're unwell, but also about being intrinsic within the community as a health resource and a mutual, if you like, a mutual effort between the clinicians and the surgery and the local people to maximise health and minimise illness.
Mm, brilliant. Sounds great. So you take all sorts of important roles in the development of national health policy as well. For example, you are currently the National Clinical Lead for Social Prescription, NHS England. As with many things NHS, That may be a somewhat opaque title for listeners. Would you like to explain exactly what you're leading there?
Yeah, well, it's something actually started with the grassroots and to some extent with a project between my own surgery in Devon and Sam Evington's in Bondi by Bow. And the aim here with surgical prescription is to enable someone who has a problem that can be helped by non-biomedical means, and that might be an artistic intervention, like a singing or a reading group, or it might be a physical intervention, like having an allotment or doing some green exercise or exercise in the gym, or it may simply be a befriending or whatever, or sometimes simply knowing a bit more about benefits, CAB sorts of work, and housing. Where they've got a social problem, that's 20% of the patients that come and see me, that we can actually offer them something tangible, also when they're ill or when they've got a major health risk. And what it does, social prescription, is it takes somebody who's often fairly demoralised at a low point in their lives and enables them to see somebody who's non-biomedical, non-judgmental, has motivational training, to try and fit a program that suits them rather than one, if you like, that's imposed on them, and then often helping to introduce them to the various interventions involved. Because often, if you're a bit demoralized, you don't want to turn up to a group, you know, completely on your own. You need someone to come and support you and take you there. Yeah. So social prescription is about enabling people to access these sorts of interventions, but facilitating them. And my role as national lead is recognition nationally that this is an important thing to do. And as national lead, I'm meant to be helping to progress this, also to shape it, and also to make sure that it stays true to what the frontline people have been beavering away over the last 2 years to create, and doesn't become, if you like, some sort of rather homogenised effort within the NHS that loses its passion and way.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great, because, of course, in the past, you know, everybody knew that lots of people would go to the doctor, not actually with a physical problem, but with a social problem or a mental problem, and the doctor didn't really have any resources to help them with it. You know, they would just prescribe a pill just to do something, I think.
For you to absolutely.
Yeah, for you to have all those resources behind you to offer is a fantastic thing.
And very important. I mean, there's a lovely GP up in Burnley who invented something called Green Dreams, Dr. James Fleming. Mm. And he said to himself one day, why on earth am I giving patients who haven't got a job antidepressants when what they really need is some help in occupational experience and getting jobs? Nice. And I think that's what social prescription does.
Excellent, very good. So another initiative that's very much your baby and that's working extremely hard to change the face of medicine, particularly in relation to chronic conditions such as cancer, is the College of Medicine. So would you tell us what the college is, what it does and why?
Well, the college is a college of all clinicians. It's the only college that takes in all clinicians, therapists and every you know, physiotherapists, doctors, nurses. And it's, I suppose you could say it's medicine beyond pills and potions. So it's looking outside that box and looking at all the possibilities that might make patients better and also all the interventions that might make them healthier. And it's a sort of co-produced college, if you like, between people, between clinicians, between really anyone who believes that there's a slightly different way. And the college believes in looking outside the box, which means, for instance, the sort of initiatives we've had in the last few years have been on food. We had conferences, Food the Forgotten Medicine, then Food the Future Medicine, yes. The biome and food becoming an enormous factor and being the major factor in terms of preventing disease, particularly infections and cancer. So we've looked at food, looked at social prescription, we've looked at the arts, we've had two major arts conferences, looking at interventions where the arts might be useful, you know, for instance, incorporating the sort of moves that physiotherapists would like patients to do with self-exercising at home after falls but find boring and can't follow them into a dance, which are much more interesting and much easier to remember, and showing that thereby you can prevent people damaging themselves and falling in future. So it's about looking outside the box, not simply accepting how things have been historically. Some of it's a bit experimental, but within the confines of being safe and being appropriate. But a lot of it is really trying to change the medical genre from a very biomedical and rather fixed perspective in some cases to one that's much more psychosocial, one that is much more connected, and one that puts patients first, not only in the sense of having treatment and health initiatives built around patients, but actually putting them in the driving seat of providing a lot of the things locally, as in my own surgery, that actually need to be done, you know, and therefore incorporating the counsellors, incorporating local leaders, the headmistresses, even the manager of the local supermarket, making sure all feel responsible for communal effort to improve health locally.
Brilliant. Well, hear, hear to all of that. I love your alternative to physio there. Dancing instead, great idea. Do you think there is progress in this field in moving away from this strictly biomedical model?
Well, there's been enormous resistance, I have to say, by some conventional elements, where they have a very narrow view of what medicine should be doing. And in fact, you know, go back 10, 15 years, and I think some of my peer group called me the vicar. That, you know, as GPs, we weren't responsible for the happiness and well-being of the community. We're simply responsible for making sure that we treated the problems that they came to see us for. Yes, I think that perspective has changed. I think if you ask the average doctor or nurse today what their role is, I think they would see it as much more general, because we're beginning to realise that how happy a person is, what level of housing they've got, what sense of community there is, are all dependent upon, first of all, how they heal, but also how healthy they are and how resilient they are to disease. You know, I mean, the statistic that's quoted so often, which is that if you've got good social relationships, that's the health equivalent of giving up smoking. And this stuff is becoming hard medicine now, and therefore something that conventional medical fraternity can't really ignore. So I think we are moving in that direction, the psychosocial direction. I think we're moving in a direction where people see they have a wider role. I think we're still stuck a bit into exactly what that wider role is. And I think there is still the usual trench warfare between the different tribes in the health service, which there ever will be, between managers and between clinicians, and particularly, I suspect, in the context of the interview, between the complementary practitioners and the more conventional practitioners who want to see themselves as two sides of the equation rather than integrated in the way that you and I want to see them.
Well, it's very interesting that in the past there was this idea that you could literally compartmentalise health into different boxes and deal with them completely separately. But I think that's the thing that's changed, is that everybody is really waking up to the connectedness of all these different elements that you've described.
Yes, and we're also working in teams now. I mean, I think what the average general practice, for instance, was a GP and a nurse and a receptionist, and now it's a much wider team with pharmacists, with nurse practitioners, and social prescribing facilitators now, and therefore we are realising that, especially with complex disease, and you know, typically we're dealing with patients in their 80s and 90s with several different problems, that we can't actually do it on one professional dimension. We need to be working with the occupational therapists, with the physiotherapists, with the district nurses. And ergo, if anyone else has got anything to help, like the therapists, then that's great. And certainly my own practice, you know, the complementary therapists have burgeoned in the last few years, as people have begun to realise that they have an enormous role in so many different problems that they come to see them for.
Right. So, you know, from all of this, it's pretty clear that you are driven by a personal agenda that favours a more holistic, integrated view of health and healthcare. So what inspired you in this direction in the first place, and how important would you say it is to the health and well-being of the nation?
Well, what was found, it was complete selfishness. That's to say, I felt very burned out to spend years into medicine with not being able to sort, you know, the welter of problems coming to see me, which were things like people who are chronically tired, people who have fibromyalgia, people with irritable bowel syndrome, constant headaches, stress, depression, back pain, neck pain. All these things were not well treated by conventional medicine alone. You had to actually look outside the box and find other things. And so the pain of facing daily suffering and not being able to do anything about it and feeling hopeless and useless, which made me look elsewhere and develop, if you like, a wider repertoire of what the possible was. What I do think is essential for the health and well-being of the nation, because people, when you look at social prescription and where it's successful, what you've done is to increase what's called the patient activation index. So you, if you like, they become more intrinsic to their healing and health, and therefore more abled within it, and therefore less using professional resources, etc., when they don't need to. So, you know, for instance, in our own practice, we did an experiment with the partners where we offered patients conventional medicines for various diseases like arthritis and not sleeping, or offered them a herbal equivalent. And often they went for the herbal equivalent, were helped by it. But more importantly, we found that when they had been helped by it, they said, well, they wouldn't come and see the doctor next time. They'd go straight to get the herbal remedy they found was helpful.
Right.
So, in terms of the well-being of society and sustainability of the health service, this is absolutely crucial. And I think the crucial element within it that I think is the theological change, if you like, between conventional professionals and the patients, is really about choice and respecting that people are different. We've been bound in modern medicine by evidence-based medicine, which is very good, population-based medicine, which tells us with some authority what treatments are likely to happen for the average person. But the problem is that no patient is either average or ordinary. And I think that pendulum needs to now swing from a total dependence on, if you like, applying population-based medicine to the individual patient, to one of saying this is an individual person who needs to maximise their own health and being able to do so, for whom we can advise using what we know from population-based evidence. It needs to be that way round. And if we get that balance better, then I think we will respect better what patients' choices, preferences, opinions are, and we will also enable them better to be agents of their own health and also agents of the health of those around them, because, you know, everyone's interconnected. And if you help one person, a family, often you get the change in dynamics that might improve things for everyone.
Yes.
And you create all sorts of virtuous circles.
Mm. Well, absolutely. I think that you're absolutely right about that role of evidence-based medicine. It's not that it's not important, but it's actually, it's prescriptive as it stands, and that's completely the wrong thing to be doing with it.
Yes, it's become a sort of tyrant, really, and a tyrant not only for patients, but also to some extent for clinicians.
I agree.
Who, if I keep to the evidence-based pathway, I will keep my nose clean and do the right thing, even if, as it were, the patient dies. But if the patient dies and I've gone off that evidence-based guideline, and you know, if whatever I do, I can justify, I will be in trouble. So, you know, our younger population of clinicians find it by far the safest route simply to follow the population-based evidence, in spite of our patients often saying, but I'm not a number, and I want to try something different. And I suppose the view of myself in the College of Medicine would be, provided it's safe, provided it's appropriate, provided people are not using a remedy that we know would be effective otherwise, particularly something serious like heart disease or cancer, then, you know, the door should be open. And we shouldn't be creating closed doors, and we shouldn't be creating closed opinions and telling patients that they shouldn't do things which we might have a particular opinion on, you see, because often doctors tell their patients, well, they shouldn't have herbal medicine, homeopathy, or whatever. But you see, my view here is that we shouldn't be so prescriptive. I mean, we may have a view, we may have a scientific view, but I'm not sure that my view is something I should impose on the patient. My duty to the patient is to make sure they get the best treatment and that they're safe, and also that they're not, you know, overcharged, for instance. But within those bounds, I should be allowing the patient to make their choices and not, I think, imposing them upon them.
Mm, love it. And ultimately, those young doctors, if they keep following what the computer says, in the end, they'll be dispensable. We can just ask the computer. And I don't think that's going to provide very good health care for people.
It won't. And also, Robin, another thing, doesn't provide very happy doctors either. Because they're always watching their back, yeah, and they're permanently fearful. And there's a real danger. The patient becomes the enemy that's about to sue them rather than the person they want to help. And I suppose, you know, from this rather dour conversation at this stage, I want to inject a bit of hope, because there is actually a large number of young doctors joining the college, coming on our foundation courses, who actually want something better. They want to be able to offer patients what they want and what they need. They don't want to be confined by some of the blocks of the past, and I feel they represent, if you like, a new wave of medicine, and particularly amongst the medical students, where they haven't yet lost their ideals. And we've got leads in all the medical schools, for instance, in social prescription and also in food, where the students are saying, for heaven's sakes, why aren't you teaching us this? And often being able to quote Academy of Medical College and GMC guidelines saying they should have been taught them. And there's, if you like, a sort of counter-revolution amongst our young doctors and medical students saying, let's think out the box, let's think a bit differently, and let's think a bit more sustainably, because they've got a very strong argument, you see, because if you look at the health service that stands, it's failed to stem the vastly increasing incidence of heart disease, of obesity, of diabetes, even of cancer, and certainly of stress and depression. So if the system isn't actually working, let's say, if we're failing to stem all these things in spite of public health and all conventional medicine can throw at it, and if we, as we know, the health service wants ever more professionals and money, is financially unsustainable, and this is a problem that all health systems in the world are facing, then, you know, logically, you need to start thinking again about exactly how you're doing things and what your ultimate aims are. And this is what these young students and young doctors are thinking. And I believe they will, in time, create something very new, exciting and different, which is a better blend of the social, the psychological and the medical.
Mm. Okay, well, that does sound hopeful, Michael. So that brings us round now to the Complementary Therapy Award. So I understand that you and the College of Medicine are right behind them. Do you want to tell us why?
Strongly supportive, because I think they give complementary medicine credibility and a profile. Mm-hmm. That's to say, awards made in recognition of good practice. First of all, they wave a flag in terms of the importance of complementary therapies. And I think that for too long, complementary therapy, therapies and complementary medicine has had to almost hide the barrage of artillery coming from a very narrow-minded and actually small number of extremely dyed-in-the-wool conventional professionals. And I think this is time for complementary medicine to raise its head and say, no, a lot of patients are coming to complementary medicine. An awful lot of doctors and nurses, particularly in primary care, recognise its importance. Mm-hmm. And it's time to, you know, rebalance its role within the health service. So that would be my first reason for saying it, which is simply about profile, credibility, and we need to start recognising its potential importance for patients. But also, I also think we need to recognise its importance to the health service, because we don't have enough professionals, we haven't got enough nurses, we haven't got enough physiotherapists, we haven't got enough doctors, and yet we've got a great number of therapists who could make a major impact there. So we need to, if you like, celebrate the wealth and variety of complementary practitioners in this country. I think we also need to celebrate those who are actually moving things forward, the people who really are going the last mile, and certainly the College of Medicine, rather like the Queen's Nursing Institute, which is we work closely with, believes in having and supporting clinicians that go the last mile that are really sort of in the vanguard. And I believe through these awards, we will be doing similar, that is to say, we'll be celebrating those that really are moving things. And because one of the things complementary medicine needs to do is to avoid the pitfalls, I think, of what conventional medicine has done, which is to simply be in the vernacular of treating patients rather than helping people to not be ill in the first place and helping the population. I think complementary medicine has an enormous role as teacher, as a social movement within local communities, beyond the individual consultation. Possibly not been allowed to do so in the past because of the private model of care within which it's had to run. But I think in future, as we start to expand our view of what local health involves and who needs to be included in that, I think complementary medicine will become a major influence, not only in terms of individual treatment, but also in terms of improving local health within our communities.
Okay, and who should consider entering for the awards?
Well, I think anybody who feels that they are doing something special. And I would hope that that will encourage people to do something special and will also encourage people to do things rather different. And I think this is another aspect of awards. It's not only about, if you like, celebrating the good. It's also about celebrating people who may have taken risks in terms of doing something a little bit differently, but have able to show results from that. So it's about variety as well, variety of ways of working, models of working, who people are working with, and what patient groups they're treating. Because the important thing is that in all this we're addressing inequalities, when we are actually focusing our efforts, particularly and wherever possible, on those that most need either health interventions or helping to reduce their health risks. And I think, you know, this has been the problem of health hitherto, is we've often been treating the worried well and preaching to the converted, whereas if we're going to get medicine right in the future, we've got to be far better at treating those that most need our help.
Okay. Well, we're going to wrap it up there. Many thanks indeed for coming on the show, Michael. I'm actually really keen to come down and visit that amazing practice of yours in Columpton, as it sounds so great. Maybe we can do an in-depth on the services you offer and the thinking behind them for another show soon.
Well, that'd be great, Robin, because, you know, I can't tell you what a difference the complementary practitioners of my practice have made to patients, the thinking of the conventional doctors and to local health. You know, we have three or four osteopaths, I think, now, hypnotists, we've got acupuncturists, reflexologists, masseurs, and a number of others, all of whom I can't tell you how often during a working day patients tell me about how much they've been helped by them, and I'll often signpost them, not sell them, simply suggest that they might be helped by a certain intervention. And, you know, almost invariably they come back and tell me they have. And this is not only helping to reduce the call upon the conventional services and general practice in my area, it's also actually safer medicine, because in the last year, also, our osteopath has picked up several problems which I would not have seen till much later, which needed treatment at an early stage. So when you get complementary practitioners working with conventional practitioners, I really think it is what Prince of Wales says, the best of both worlds, because not only giving the best treatment, it's also giving you the safest possible treatment, because they're working together and they're both joining forces. And I really do hope that this is a model that we'll be able to progress in the future throughout the health service.
Well, me too. It sounds absolutely brilliant and exactly what we'd like to see as well, real collaboration for the benefit of the patient. All right, thank you very much, Michael.
Great pleasure, Robin, and nice to speak to you, and very much look forward to the awards themselves. Bye-bye.
I hope you found that interesting. If you're thinking of entering, or if you know someone who you think should be entering, then visit the awards website, which is at www.complementarytherapyawards.co.uk, where you'll find out a lot more about the scheme. A reminder that there's a Walida skincare talk and pamper workshop on the 19th of July in Rudolf Steiner House, London. Check the Yes to Life website, that's yestolife.org.uk, and look under events, or look on the Yes to Life Facebook page for the full details. Also, the Yes to Life 10K run on the 6th of October is open for entries and has its own website at yestolife10k.org. That's yestolife10k.org. You'll find all the details there. Hope you'll be able to join me again next week for another Yes to Life show. Goodbye.